From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Jody Heiss.
The Republicans are not going to be a party to this. They have taken hostage the funding processes of government so that they can impose their radical agenda on the American people, and we can't have any part of it. This gambit that was done last night is a joke.
Well, that was House Speaker Mike Johnson earlier today as the House prepared to take up a Senate-passed bill to fund and reopen the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome to this March 27th edition of Washington Watch. I am your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Welcome aboard. Thanks for joining. All right, coming up today, House Republicans this afternoon formally rejected the Senate's compromise deal to fund most of DHS. It would have excluded ICE and U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So what's next? Well, we'll hear from both the House side and the Senate side. Well, we're joined by Congressman Glenn Grothman and Senator Ron Johnson. Plus, there's big tech news this week. They lost two major cases regarding the way they harm young people. And internet safety expert Donna Rice Hughes will be joining us later to discuss the implications. All right, the U.S. Senate reached a deal around 3 a.m. this morning to try to fund most of the Department of Homeland Security. Of course, they were attempting to put an end to the shutdown, but House Republicans are not happy about it. And joining us now to give the details is Washington Watch reporter Mary Stackhouse. Mary, it sounds like there's a lot of drama taking place. What's unfolded?
Indeed, Jody. House Republicans opposed the Senate's bill to fund most of DHS. House Speaker Mike Johnson said that his chamber would look in to pass a resolution to fund the entire department for the next 8 weeks. The legislation passed by the Senate would have financed most of DHS, including TSA, the U.S. Coast Guard, and FEMA, but not ICE and not parts of CBP. The dispute over immigration enforcement reform between Democrats and Republicans remains unsolved. Today marks day 42 of the partial government shutdown. The shutdown has, of course, led to long security lines at airports across the country as hundreds of TSA officers have quit and others have called out of work since the shutdown began. Jody?
Well, we will certainly be keeping a watch on that. If I can, real quickly, Mary, turn to some international news. The president has extended his deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz by 10 days. So, in the meantime, we have a continued pause on strikes on Iranian power plants. Can you walk us through the latest developments there?
Sure, Jody. This is the second time that President Trump has extended the deadline. He says that talks with Iran are ongoing. However, some sources in Iran have denied that negotiations are taking place. Also, there's been no indication that Iran is letting up on their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which is, of course, a major oil route. Since the conflict began, traffic in the sea passage is down by 90%, which has spiked prices of global oil. Iran reportedly has said that there will be, quote, harsh measures for any transit through the strait. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is considering sending 10,000 more troops to the Middle East, according to a senior U.S. defense official. Jody?
All right, Mary, thank you so much. We appreciate it. In fact, here in just a little while, we're going to have former U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Elliot Abrams, to talk more in depth about the conflict in the Middle East and what's going on there. But before we get to that, I want to move over to what's happening on Capitol Hill, specifically as it relates to DHS funding and that battle. Joining me now to discuss this is Congressman Glenn Grothman. He's a member of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. He represents the 6th Congressional District of Wisconsin. Congressman Grothman, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always an honor to have you, sir.
Well, glad to be on the show. We're still in Washington tonight, which is a little later than we intended a couple days ago.
All right, so let's go to this DHS funding battle. Why are House Republicans opposed to the Senate's bill?
Well, the Senate bill does not adequately fund either ICE or the Border Patrol. Now, I think what the senators in support of that would tell you because we have enough money available right now that we can do a reconciliation package and get the money to fund these two vital organizations before they run out of money. The problem is we have a very slim majority in the House of Representatives, and there is no guarantee that we can put together any package that will only cause us to lose two votes and could easily be one vote. And therefore, we feel it would be reckless not to pass a bill that is fully funding both ICE and Border Patrol right now. You might ask, why don't the Democrats contribute any money here? As is sadly true and been shown again and again, the Democrats do not like ICE or Border Patrol. They do not right now like to fund our immigration laws at all. This has been shown several times over the last few years. You'll recall in the 2016 election, every prominent Democrat said that they were not for fund or for fund. They were for funding free medical care for all people who were in this country illegally. Then when Joe Biden was president, he basically let anybody in here who showed up. And now we see that since ICE and Border Patrol are the two law enforcement agencies responsible for enforcing the border, we see that the Democrats see no necessity in giving them any money, which, of course, would turn around. Go ahead.
Yeah, so what's the way forward? How do we move beyond this?
Well, there are a variety of things that appear in this bill. Donald Trump solved the biggest problem by he just plain announced that he is going to fund people at the airports. And I think that of all the things that Homeland Security does, that's the one thing that has to get done and the people care about. So since he has just announced he is going to fund that, I think the other parts of the law, well, hopefully we'll be able to come to a compromise on them. The public does not feel the sense of necessity, and we may just go on for a while without any other parts of this program being funded.
Wow. What a mess. Thank you so much, Wisconsin Congressman Glenn Grothman. Always great to have you joining us. All right, now let's jump over to the other big issue that's taking place right now. That is the conflict that's unfolding with Iran as negotiations continue and the U.S. continues to ramp up its military presence in the Middle East. Are we at all close to a deal with Iran? Well, joining us now to break down these developments is Elliot Abrams, a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He previously served as the U.S. Special Representative for Iran during the first Trump administration. Elliot, welcome to Washington Watch. It's an honor to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
All right. So what do you make of the peace talks that are taking place? Are we at all close to making a deal with Iran?
I don't think so. If you look at our demands and theirs, there's really a big difference. There's really a gap between them. I think it's more likely that the president is going to hit the targets he wants to hit over the next couple of weeks and then basically stop. So I think it's more likely that we have a kind of ceasefire on both sides than that we have, you know, a negotiated 10-page peace treaty.
Well, we're hearing about the potential, at least, of a deployment of an additional 10,000 troops or something in that general ballpark. One would think that that would be even just the threat of it would pose a lot of pressure to maybe push Iran to make a deal. Do you think there's any possibility of that?
Well, I thought that this morning that I don't know whether the president intended to use the troops, but it is a form of pressure. But according to news reports, Secretary Rubio said, meeting with the Europeans today, we don't need ground troops to achieve everything we want to achieve. Now, maybe that's a ruse, a feint, you know, to mislead the Iranians. And it is hard to believe the president would send thousands of troops if he really doesn't have any intention of using them. And if he doesn't, you know, then Secretary Rubio should not have said what he said. He should not have, in a sense, reassured the Iranians indirectly that we weren't planning to use them. Maybe the president means for the Iranian mainland, and he still might take an island or two. But my sense of it is he's going to continue the air war for a while and hope that the Iranians basically realize they'd better stop.
Yeah, you would think that they would be getting that message. So what about Israel in all of this? What role does Israel have, or what role does Israel want when it comes to collaborating in this operation?
Right. I think, for one thing, they'll stop and we stop. That is, it's like in the 12-day war last year, when the president said, we're done, it's over. The Israelis said, okay. They had probably intended to do more, but once he said stop, they stopped. And I think this time, too, if he in a week or 10 days or whatever says, okay, we're done, they will stop. But it is worth saying, I don't think we've had a military partner like this really since the British in World War II. You know, there were countries helping us in Vietnam and in Afghanistan, the South Koreans in Vietnam, a bunch of countries in Afghanistan, really probably more than about a dozen. But, you know, we were so much the senior partner, and they were kind of symbolic. This is different. This is really having a full partnership here with the Israeli Air Force. But again, we're the senior partner, and when the president says it's over, it's going to be over.
Okay, so when is that going to happen? How long do you see this conflict playing out?
Well, initially, the United States said this was something like 4 weeks. The Israelis had said 4 to 6 weeks. We're now in week four. Apparently, Secretary Rubio said we might need a couple more weeks. So we are, I think, going to get into April, which is just around the corner. I wouldn't see it going beyond around the middle of the month. So my guess, my estimate is a couple more weeks. Maybe you get to about April 15th. But I think it's not going to go beyond that.
And real quickly, we've got about 30 seconds or so. Do you think enough damage has been done and enough of a strong message been sent to stop Iran from being the threat that they were?
I think we've degraded them fantastically well. I don't trust them. They may, you know, particularly after President Trump is gone, they may try to rebuild. And you have to hope that whoever is president next has the guts that President Trump does to really enforce what we're saying.
All right. Thank you so much, Elliot Abrams, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Great to have you joining us on Washington Watch. Thank you. All right. By the way, I want to invite each of you to join us for the most important thing we can be doing during this critical hour, and that is to pray. This is a time for us to pray, and we welcome you to come on board with us. To get more info, simply text the word Iran, text Iran to 67742 and commit to prayer. All right, coming up, we're going to go further into the DHS funding battle. We're going to jump over to the Senate side. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin will be joining me next. So stick around. We'll be right back.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another,
and to assume among the powers of the earth
the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature
and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind
requires that they should declare the causes
which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
That they're endowed by their Creator
with certain unalienable rights.
That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men,
deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th birthday, America.
May God bless America.
I think all people really need to have this type of education.
Well, I can tell you that it's been an amazing course, period.
I think this course is a reminder that a biblical worldview should really impact everything. It impacts our government from the federal to the state to the local. It should impact what we're doing with our families and with our work.
God and Government is a video-driven, Bible-based training course from Family Research Council that explores the connection between biblical principles and American government. In this six-session video series, FRC President Tony Perkins equips participants with a practical understanding of civil government from a biblical worldview.
I would encourage all people to take it. I almost wish I would have took it earlier. That I could have taught my kids this.
I wish I had known these things when we were homeschooling, because I think children and my adults now would just greatly be influenced by that information.
So I'm an attorney, and for me, it gives me some direct practical knowledge of what I can do to try to impact my legal community, to make better legislation, to try to encourage legislators to make choices that have a biblical worldview, which is what we really want.
Any pastor would benefit from taking this course, because we are dual citizens, right? We are citizens of the kingdom of God, but we're also citizens of this great land, and that comes with responsibility.
Even as someone who has been involved in these types of issues for a while, you're learning little bits and pieces of new stuff all the time, but it's also approachable enough that newer people, younger people, high school, college students, they can really glean something from this. So I would encourage everybody to take this course, whether it's the videos, whether it's doing it in person. Bring your Bible study group through it, bring your homeschool group through it, and equip yourself for these challenging days ahead.
View the course at frc.org/godandgovernment or on the Stand Firm app.
I am Jody Heist, your Friday host. Thanks so much for tuning in. Welcome back to Washington Watch. Glad to have you. All right. Earlier this morning, it appeared as if the second longest government shutdown in U.S. history would soon be coming to an end. In the early hours this morning, the Senate voted to fund most of the Department of Homeland Security, excluding ICE and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. But then as the bill, although it passed the Senate, when it went over to the House just a little while ago, earlier this afternoon, the House rejected the deal. So what does all this mean? Well, joining us now to discuss this is Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. He's a member of the Senate Budget Committee, as well as the Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. Senator Johnson, it's always an honor to have you on Washington Watch. Thanks for taking time to join us.
Well, Jody, hope you're doing well.
I'm doing very well. Listen, I should note, and I should have probably added this, that I understand the Senate voted earlier this morning by a voice vote. But can you kind of go over how things unfolded in the Senate before the vote in the wee hours this morning?
Well, the first reality everybody has to accept, and I don't like it, the legacy of the corporate media is pretty much the communication arm of the Democrat Party. So Democrats with impunity can obstruct, they can shut down government, they can, you know, make sure that people who are living paycheck to paycheck get no paychecks whatsoever, and they pay no political price for it. They're not held accountable for it, no pressure is put on them. If the tables were turned, and this was Republicans voting time and time again not to open up government, not to fund these agencies, we would be eviscerated in the media. We would have caved within a couple of days. Democrats can continue this, and they did continue it for 40 plus days. Finally, Republicans said, okay, listen, we've got to fund these people. We need to get paychecks in their pockets. I had an email, you know, I'm the guy who sponsored the Shutdown Fairness Act that's supported by 33 different groups, including the American Federation of Government Employees, the Teamsters Union. We got an email from one of the union reps saying that their president of one of their regions said that he had people coming to him asking if their life insurance policy covered suicide. Okay? Now, you've got to take that seriously. These are real people struggling to get by, and we're playing these, Democrats are playing these political games. So at some point, Republicans said, okay, we'll accept what we can get. The good news is ICE and CBP were funded by the One Big Beautiful Bill for a period of time. So we have a way to cure this. What we need to do is get this behind us, get on the same page, and now through reconciliation, a very focused, a very rapidly passed reconciliation bill. My suggestion is let's pass all of DHS for the Trump term and beyond. You know, again, it's going to be a big price tag, but it's going to be it's going to be in lieu of appropriations, so Democrats can never use DHS and the men and women of DHS as pawns in their political games. So we can do that, but we need to get started on that. At some point in time, the House is going to have to recognize the awful reality that Republicans in the Senate didn't want to recognize either. But at some point in time, you say, listen, these people have got to get a paycheck. That's what we agreed to do last night. The good news for TSA, President Trump signed an executive order. He'll repurpose funds. But what that means is that that amount of money that can be repurposed to fund ICE and CBP is going to run out just that much quicker.
Yeah, it's all a complicated web that is just, and you're right. I mean, the Democrats and the media have just been unbelievable in all of this. So let's move into this afternoon. The House rejected the deal this afternoon. So your thoughts on that and what happens from here? And then I do want to go back to your discussion on reconciliation. But what about the House today?
Well, again, I'm disappointed in that. Listen, I completely agree with him. Democrats are being grossly unreasonable. But again, we can't force Democrats to do certain things when you have no accountability, no pressure by the mainstream media. So that's the pickle we're in as Republicans. It's not a fair fight. It's not a level playing field. So I'm not sure how Senate leadership's going to handle that, whether they're going to put that on the floor and just ask to pass that by unanimous consent as well, because you know people have left town. Now, we'd all come back if we could pass it. Again, it's not going to pass. I mean, if we could have passed something, we would have done that. We would have done that days ago, weeks ago. But it's not going to pass. So it'll be right back in this House's lap, and they're going to figure out, are they going to take yes for an answer and then work toward a reconciliation process where we can, again, I'm calling it a reconciliation appropriation process. And from my standpoint, not only do we need to do that for DHS for multiple years in the future, but we need to have a strategy now. I'm calling it a reconciliation appropriations process, because I don't think Democrats are going to play ball and fund government through the normal appropriation process prior to September 30th. And by the way, Jody, just real quick, you know, I'm supportive of ending the filibuster. As much as I'd like to have that, we're in the minority to stop awful legislation by the Democrats, they're going to end it. So, you know, I'm supportive of that. But short of that, what we need to do is we need to be prepared for the Democrat obstructionism and use what levers we have, which is reconciliation, to make sure that government doesn't shut down. But what I was going to say is I've been here for 15 years. We should have passed 180 appropriation bills on time prior to the fiscal year as funding. We passed six. That's a failure rate of 96.7%. So, you know, my colleagues who say, oh, we can't end the filibuster, we don't want to wreck the Senate. How could the Senate be more broken? How could this be more dysfunctional? Yeah. How could this be a bigger mess? I'm willing to make that change.
All right, great point. We've got less than a minute to go. The CR, I'm hearing word of a 260-day CR in the House. That may pass, but you don't think it will gain an end solution. Do you really think the reconciliation idea can win?
Oh, absolutely. No, if we keep it focused, we just fund DHS. And again, we can do it because there's no appropriation for it. So normally you can't go back and fiddle with discretionary spending in a reconciliation process. But where there's no appropriation, we just appropriate through the mandatory spending process. So we'll turn DHS, at least for the years we do it, we'll turn that into mandatory spending.
Very, very interesting concept. I've heard a lot of folks say that funding something like this through reconciliation cannot be done. But it sounds to me like the way you're talking about it, there's a path forward through that. So very, very interesting concept to go through that. In about 15 seconds or so before I let you go, Mark Wayne Mullen, what do you expect from him?
He's a loyal supporter of President Trump. They know each other. They are friends. I mean, I asked Mark Wayne Mellon to tell a story about what President Trump did with his son that was grievously injured. He will implement President Trump's strategy in terms of fixing the enormous mess the Democrats left behind for President Trump and Department of Homeland Security.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, always great to have you. Thank you for joining us. All right, friends, after the break, a big, big week. Bad week for big tech, but a good week for others. We'll tell you after the break.
For over 4,000 years, the Jewish people have had legal, historical, and biblical ties to the land of Israel, especially the heartland of Israel, Judea and Samaria, which much of the world still calls the West Bank. To Israelis, Judea and Samaria is far more than a name. It's the center of their ancestral homeland, where nearly 80% of the Bible's events took place. Abraham purchased property in Hebron, Jacob in Shechem. Joshua made an altar on Mount Ebal and led the Israelites into a covenant before God. On Mount Gerizim, overlooking Shechem, Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well about worshiping neither on Mount Gerizim nor in Jerusalem, but in spirit and in truth. Judea and Samaria is nearly a quarter of Israel's current landmass, not a small strip of land on the Jordan River, but a vital and strategic part of the nation's identity. The October 7th massacre, launched from Gaza, shattered the illusion that giving away territory brings peace. Gaza, which was once seen as the cornerstone of a two-state solution, became a launchpad for terror. Today, only 21% of Israelis support a Palestinian state. Trust in a two-state solution has all but collapsed. The Middle East is changing. Iran's grip is weakening. New alliances are forming. But Western countries and some U.S. officials still chase the mirage of a two-state solution. History speaks clearly. The 2005 Gaza withdrawal, backed by the U.S., led not to peace, but to a terrorist regime. Judea and Samaria are 24 times larger than Gaza, deeply woven into Israel's geographic and spiritual fabric. To surrender them would not bring peace. It would invite conflict and existential danger. Family Research Council stands with Israel's rightful claim to sovereignty. It's time for America to do the same, for history, for justice, and for lasting security in the Middle East.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your Friday host, Jody Heiss. Thanks so much for tuning in with us today. All right, this week has not been a good week for big tech giants, especially Meta, which they, of course, own Instagram and Facebook. But on Tuesday, New Mexico became the first state in the nation to prevail at a trial against a major tech company for harming young people. A jury found that they were liable for misleading consumers about the safety of its platforms and for endangering children. And then one day later, in another landmark case, a California jury found both Meta and Google were negligent in the design or operation of their platforms also, which included features which were engineered to be addictive to children. So just how significant are these developments? Well, joining us now to discuss this is internet safety expert Donna Rice Hughes. She's the president and CEO of Enough is Enough, or EIE. Donna, welcome to Washington Watch. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you. And it has been a stellar week for children and families and a really bad week for big tech, not just Meta and not just Google, because this sends a clarion call to all these big tech companies that they better start putting safety over profits or there's going to be a big price to pay. And as you mentioned,
that's
in that
great
New Mexico case, over, let's see, $375 million. So I love the fact that the jury made it hurt because these companies pay attention to their bottom line. And so in the case of the New Jersey case, let me just give you some data points, because this was about, as you mentioned, child online exploitation. They found in discovery, which is what happens when you go into these lawsuits, that you can't get in a hearing, for instance, before Congress, that over 500,000 children per day were targeted with sexually explicit messages on Facebook. Point one. Point two.
Wow.
Yeah, 500,000 per day. All right. Just let that
wow
sink in a minute. Right.
Yeah.
7.5 million images or reports of child sex abuse material. That's child pornography that Zuckerberg and Meta hid They didn't report this because they wanted it to go into their encryption, end-to-end encryption. So these are most likely images of real children, real toddlers, real babies being sexually exploited, raped, and victimized that they sat on. Point three. I mean, these are the ones that just got my goat, Jody, so I just got to share it.
Yes.
Was that the former head of Instagram said that the policy of Meta was that they would not do anything about a report on sex trafficking unless it was reported at least 17 times. Really? I mean,
whoa
is right. And wow. So thank God for the attorney general who said, enough is enough. This ain't going to fly. And they won. So this is big. Now, the California case was significantly different. As you said, this was about dealing with the way the architecture of these social media and gaming platforms, not just social media, but also gaming, that they are deliberately designing their algorithms and their platforms to hook people, not just kids, but in this case, you know, the plaintiff was a teenage girl. So what they did, and they got around Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which was brilliant, because they didn't make it about content, they made it about design. Huge precedent.
Wow.
So both of these came out, you know, within a day, and it's just saying enough is enough. You better fix these platforms. You're going to be paying a price, and you're also going to get a lot of negative press, which they have.
Wow. That's incredible information. I'm glad you went there, because I was going to ask you what was some of the evidence that was brought forth in the case, and you just nailed it. I think it's worth noting, too, some of the companies that we're dealing with here. I mean, you had Instagram, for example, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat. I mean, there were other companies, as I understand, who settled out of court. So what's going to come of all this? When you say this was so huge, like, what is this going to lead to more accountability? Is it going to, what is it that we are going to see in terms of improvement?
I think what we're going to see, big tech companies get hit at some key pressure points for them. One is impacting their bottom line, right? Okay, because they put safety over profits, and where now they're having to pay some significant fees, particularly that $375 million, even though the California case was $6 million. But that's still, you know, that's still enough to get their attention. The other thing is I think that it will encourage others to bring lawsuits, because they go, we can win. Just think back to big tobacco. You know, if they think they can get a winning verdict, people will start to sue. It also emboldens, in my opinion, Congress to say, okay, we have got to prevent this. Okay, because remember, after the case, when you have these cases of real victims, et cetera, kids are already being harmed. We want to prevent that harm. So I believe that Congress is going to be emboldened. There are multiple bills in the United States Senate. Everything that we work on in the Senate is bipartisan, which is a great thing in a divided country, that protecting kids online is a unifying issue. And so hopefully, you know, they'll start to do the right thing. And I'm glad they got hit, and I'm glad they got hit hard. And you mentioned two other companies that were...
Real quickly, just a few seconds left.
Yeah. We're sued in California. It was TikTok and Snapchat, and they wisely settled out of court. And I'm sure they're glad they did. And I bet now that Google and Meta wish that they had too, because they got hit hard.
Thank you so much, Donna Rice Hughes, President and CEO of Enough is Enough. Big, big news. Thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. Friends, this is a time as parents, Christians, get involved with what's happening, what your kids are watching. All right, next, our Biblical Worldview segment to wrap up the week. So stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
The family is the oldest, most tested, and most reliable unit of society. It is divinely created and sustained. And yet, there are those who are always tampering with its values and structure. That's why we need organizations like the Family Research Council that can effectively defend and strengthen the family.
Family Research Council began over 40 years ago, like all great movements of God, with prayer. Today, Rooted in the heart of the nation's capital, FRC continues to champion faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview.
FRC is one of those bright lights that helps us focus on true north. And I shudder to think, had they not been here, that it could have been worse, worse, worse.
The Family Research Council is key. It's one of a handful of groups that I think will determine whether our children live in a country that enjoyed all of the freedom and all the opportunity that we enjoyed in this great land.
It's just a wonderful parachurch organization that doesn't seek to take the place of the church, but it seeks to assist the family and the church as we try to move forward successfully, not in a defensive mode, but in an offensive mode as we seek to live our lives according to the Holy Scriptures.
FRC is not going to be whooped. we're going to fight. We're going to take a stand. And again, we don't retreat.
You will never see in front of this building here in Washington, D.C., a white flag fly. We will never step back. We will never surrender. And we will never be silent.
Should a Christian support Israel? That question has become one of the most emotionally charged issues of our time, both in the world and within the church. Family Research Council President Tony Perkins offers a clear, biblical, and prophetic answer. In his latest book, he examines Israel's past, present, and future through the lens of Scripture, revealing why support for Israel is not rooted in politics, partisanship, or cultural sentiment, but in the unchanging promises of God. Drawing from Genesis to Revelation, Tony Perkins demonstrates that the ultimate rationale for a Christian support for Israel is spiritual. Should a Christian support Israel invites believers to see beyond headlines and ideologies, returning to the foundation of God's Word to understand His heart for His chosen people and the blessings that flow when we stand with what He has established forever. Text the word Israel to 67742 for more information.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thank you so much for joining us. I am Jody Heiss, your Friday host, and glad to have you joining us today. All right, no surprise, but there was no shortage of the news this week among all the activity on Capitol Hill, along with the war that's still raging in Iran. And unfortunately, you know, sometimes there are some significant developments out there that can be drowned out during a week like we've had this week. So as we like to do each Friday, we want to conclude the week and the program with a biblical worldview segment that takes a look at some of the headlines through the lens of Scripture. But we also want to take a look at some other significant developments that were not in the top tier of the news, but items that certainly need and deserve our attention, particularly some related to the LGBT movement this week. And joining me now to discuss them is Dr. David Clawson. Of course, he's the director of the Center for Biblical Worldview here at FRC. Dr. Clawson, as always, happy Friday. Welcome back to the show.
Happy Friday. Great to be with you again, Jody.
All right. Well, we've got a lot to discuss, so let's jump in it. I know earlier this week you wrote an article for the Washington Stand highlighting several recent developments related to transgender ideology. And you noted that public opinion seems to be moving in a more common sense direction, shall we put it that way? And of course, all that's happening while activists in many institutions continue to double down on their positions. So let's start with all of this discussion. Is the transgender ideology actually in retreat?
Yeah, Jody, great question. Is transgender ideology in retreat? I think that's a pertinent and relevant question as we make our way through the first quarter of 2026. And I think my answer really is yes and no. There are certainly signs that transgender ideology is losing ground in the broader culture. And I talk about this in the article. It's clear that public opinion has begun to shift significantly, especially if you go back to 2022, in particular on two issues, men in competing against women in sports, as well as surgeries and medical interventions for minor children. The polling, even legal challenges, some high-profile examples, I think, really demonstrate that. Even on the sports issue, the fact that the Supreme Court is set to render a judgment on the constitutionality of an Idaho and West Virginia law just later this year. But as you said in your intro, Jody, at the same time that the broader culture seems to be returning to kind of a common sense understanding of this issue, of course, as Christians, we would say this is a creation order understanding of how God created the universe. The political and kind of institutional landscape, I don't think has really caught up. Because we are seeing, again, well, everyday average Americans are kind of rediscovering biological truths. The Democratic Party and a lot of these activist groups are really still committed to advancing their agenda, which is, I think, why you can have overwhelming political support amongst the people for something such as not allowing men to compete in women's sports. And yet, and this went under the radar just a few days ago, every single United States senator who is a Democrat voted against an amendment to the Save America Act that would have prohibited men from competing against women in sports. And so let me just say this. The ideology may be in retreat culturally, but it still has very strong institutional backing, which tells me this debate is far from over.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I know earlier in the week we dealt with the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, and that their decision. Previously, individual sports like track and field and swimming, cycling, some of those others had some restrictions for biological males competing in women's sports. But this week, their announcement seemed to be much more broadly directed across all sports. In fact, I have a real quick clip here, David. Let me play this for you, and then we'll talk about it. Play clip three for me.
With respect to sex, that the working group defines sex as either of the two categories, male or female, into which humans are divided according to their reproductive biology. And they reach consensus that male sex confers performance advantage in all sports and events that rely on strength, power, and or endurance.
Those are pretty strong words. What do you think has led to this shift?
I think there's a couple of things that have led to this shift. And the clip you just played, that's the president, the newly elected president of the International Olympic Committee. And when she was running for that position, this issue came up. And she made it clear, even before assuming office, that this was an issue she was going to study. And I think to her credit, the IOC has released a report that talks about fairness. It looks at the science. Further on in the clip that you just played in the same press conference, she went on to say, even the smallest margins can be the difference between victory and defeat when referring to the advantages that a male body has when it goes through puberty. And so I'd say what's led to this, Jody, is the issue of fairness. It's the fact that the IOC has actually looked at the science. But I will say, I think even if they're going to deny it, the kind of the growing global pressure and awareness, she went on to say that President Trump's executive orders really had nothing to do with this, that she was studying this issue even before President Trump's executive orders. But knowing that the next Summer Olympics is in Los Angeles, I think it is clear, Jody, that the growing, and you mentioned it was three main sports, swimming, track and field, and cycling. Their sports bodies had already prohibited biological men from competing in women's divisions. Now you're right. This is going to cover all sports. And I think let's give credit for where credit is due. There just seems to be the moment that we're in where reality respecting is back in vogue, and we should celebrate that.
Well, and as you mentioned, though, there's still some pushback, and not everyone is on board with it. I mean, just yesterday we saw reports that the American Medical Association appears, at least, to have reversed course yet again on transgender surgeries for minors. What do we know about what's happening there?
Yeah, so this is breaking within just the last day or two, Jody. It's so interesting. So, of course, you and I have covered this story. It was a few weeks ago where the first settlement was given by a jury to a detransitioner, a beautiful young lady who had been wrestling and confused with her gender. And then she ended up identifying again with the beautiful young lady that she is. And she sued her psychologist and doctor and won a $2 million settlement. Within days, you had the American Plastic Surgeons Association reverse their decision. And in the press reports that we saw, the American Medical Association, they said they agreed with the plastic surgeons. And clearly what's happened, and I know the Washington Stands reported on this as well, there was a backlash internally. And so in their newsletter that went public just yesterday, they had to walk this back and say, well, actually, we're still in favor of so-called gender-affirming care. And so I think what we see is there are still amongst the elite professions a strong resistance to what we're seeing more in the general public, this pushback against transgender ideology. And especially, Jody, on this issue of minor children, we are seeing irreparable harm being perpetrated against minor children through puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and even irreversible surgeries. I think it's over 20-plus states now that do not allow these interventions for minor children. And yet, as of now, the AMA's about face once again shows that in some cases, politics is always going to be given preference over good medicine. That's a shame. And we'll just have to see how the story continues to play out.
Yeah, well, while you're talking about that, it reminds me, David, that there is a bill right now that's been introduced in Congress that would indeed protect children from the permanent damages of these so-called gender transition procedures. And it would really, in essence, just reaffirm the biology, the reality of God creating two sexes. It's called the Chloe Cole Act. I know we've talked about this. We've dealt with this on the program. But I want to encourage those who are watching and listening right now to send a message to your members of Congress. Urge them to support this very important bill, the Chloe Cole Act. And for your voice to be heard, you can just very easily text the word KIDS, K-I-D-S, to 67742, and let your voice be heard. We want to protect children. David, what you're talking about is so important. If I can, let me come back. Let's switch gears. I know this is a big one for you as well. Yesterday, Finland's Supreme Court issued a ruling in the long-running case involving Päivi Rosanen. And, I mean, you followed this. We've all been watching this case for years, and there was an acquittal on one charge, but also she was found guilty in regard to a booklet that she wrote over 20 years ago. And yesterday I had Congressman Chip Roy on me. We were talking about this. I wanted to play a little bit of a clip of something he said and get your reaction to this. Play clip four for me, please.
But what happened to Päivi should be a glimpse into the future and be very concerning for the average American. You know, if I say something about marriage being between a man and a woman, and I've done it many times in my life, I'm a member of Congress, I'm the equivalent as she is in Finland, and 20 years from now, some leftists get in power, pass a law, and then they look backwards, and they go and say, oh, well, this is somehow hate speech. You know, you got to wonder what's coming if we don't double down and preserve and protect our liberties.
I thought that was a great point. And so here we have this important decision taking place. What are the potential implications for Christians even here in the United States?
Yeah, the situation in this case involving Päivi, this matters because it demonstrates very clearly what happens when the interests of LGBT activists are prioritized over the values of free speech and religious freedom. And you're absolutely right, Judy. Here you have a member of parliament, the equivalent of a member of Congress, who was prosecuted and ultimately now convicted for expressing the views that the Bible has on marriage and homosexuality. And so this is deeply concerning because this is happening, of course, in a Western democracy that claims to protect free speech and religious freedom. You know, it was interesting. You're right. She was acquitted on the tweet that she put out, I think, in 2019, but found guilty in a very close 3-2 decision about this 2004 booklet. Right before coming on the program, Jody, I went back. The booklet is 24 pages. You can pull up the PDF online. I read half of it just before I came on. There is nothing, in my view, that's malicious or salacious about this booklet. It just articulates the beliefs and convictions that Christians have held and articulated for millennia. And so the fact that she could be prosecuted is deeply concerning. What's really concerning is she was actually the portion of the law that she was prosecuted under falls under the area of law where war crimes and crimes against humanity are prosecuted. And so, Jody, this should get everyone's attention. For Christians here in the United States, this is sobering. And it, again, tells us because, Jody, there are already voices in the United States that are advocating that the Christian convictions that tens of millions of Americans hold on the Bible's teaching on marriage and sexuality, that they should be considered hate speech. There are already voices, some even in our nation's capital, advocating to have our laws applied like they are in Finland. And so deeply concerning, something that should have our attention. We need to be praying for Pavi, as I believe she's considering an appeal to the European High Court. But this definitely should have all of our attention.
Yeah, and you know, when she wrote the book, again, we're talking over 20 years ago, it was a pretty commonly accepted view 20 years ago. So it's not like she was under attack back then for writing a biblical view of marriage. It was pretty generally accepted that that was a view of marriage. But now, all of a sudden, even as Chip Roy was saying, they look back 20-plus years later and say, oh, that was a crime. It's just unbelievable. I personally hope she does appeal. Let me ask you another one. In Pennsylvania this week, Democrats withdrew a resolution recognizing National Women's Month, and they did so after a Republican lawmaker introduced an amendment requiring them to define what a woman is in biological terms. Tell us what happened there.
This is a remarkable story from the state of Pennsylvania, Jody. You're right. This in the video you can find online. And simply someone introduced a resolution celebrating women. And pretty much what you just explained happened. You have a Republican member of the state assembly move to add an amendment that simply defines what a woman is. So, you know, we're celebrating March, Women's Month. And, okay, let's just make sure we all understand what this is. And the assemblyman, he said it succinctly and politely. He's with his amendment, just adding a physiological definition. And you could just see, I think Democrats have a two-seat majority, so they control the proceedings on the floor there in the House. And they had to kind of huddle and talk with one another. And then the thing that was the parliamentarian simply said, well, the resolution is being shelved for now. And so, again, this tells you really everything you need to know. The irony, of course, is that you have this movement that claims to champion women, and it ultimately can't even define what a woman is. And so, again, I think most Americans are going to see this for what it is. They're going to see that this is out of step with reality. But it does tell us again, Jody, we started the segment talking about this, that even though if the polling and that the average American is moving in the direction of reality respecting those who control the levers of power in a lot of our institutions, they are still beholden to the transgender ideology. That's why all of us need to continue to press the case, and for those of us who are Christians, continue to press the case that this is God's design, Genesis 1 and 2, Ephesians 5, and we just need to continue to make that case clearly, compassionately, but with conviction.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just couldn't help but chuckle when I saw that come down the way it did, that they're all going out there celebrating Women's Month and, well, what is a woman? Oh, and just instant panic that they withdrew their resolution. It underscores the lunacy, really, of so much where we're living. Thank you so much, Dr. David Clawson, director of the Center for Biblical Worldview here at the Family Research Council. I hope you have a great weekend. All right, friends, that wraps up this edition and this week of Washington Watch. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you again right here next week.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council. To support our efforts to advance faith, family, and freedom, please text GIVE to 67742. That's GIVE to 67742. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information, please visit TonyPerkins.com.